Hello, fellow life extension enthusiasts. Welcome to another episode of Longevity Now, the place for all your news and views of life extension from around the world. Today, we are going back to the UK, Loughborough University to be exact, to have a conversation with Professor Alexandra Stolzing. She should be familiar to you since you helped two of her rejuvenation research projects, one involving brain aging and microglia, and the other tracking aging biomarkers. Thanks to you and your generous member donations at Longevity, both of these projects got off the ground, and both are moving forward in various ways. Listen in to find out more, and hear what Professor Stolzing does to keep herself healthy. And now I would like to welcome to the Longevity Now podcast, Dr. Alexandra Stolzing, who is a professor for biogerontological engineering at Loughborough University in the UK. A familiar guest. Thank you for coming back on the podcast again.
Yeah, so happy to be back here after so many years. It has been too long.
It's been a few years, and you know Longevity has very happily supported some of your research throughout the years. So let's start going back a little bit just to remind folks. One of the first projects we helped support was your microglia research. Could you please give us the summary of how what you did a few years ago and how that type of research has progressed in recent years? Perhaps not your own, but how you have seen things progress in dementia and Alzheimer's type research.
Yeah, so I was very much a fan of like cell replacement and cell therapy approaches. So basically the regenerative medicine approach to fixing the brain, helping an aged brain reset itself. And so the idea was replacing a cell type that was known to be part of the neuroinflammation. So the microglia cell is really kind of a macrophage-like type of the brain and is part of this problem of inflammation leading to neuronal damage. And so the idea was, because a lot of people were already working on neuronal replacement, providing new neurons to the brain, I would be working on the glia cells. So, and the microglia cells was kind of the one that I worked on during my PhD. And so it was already very familiar to me. And so the basic idea was just delivering new young microglia cells to the brain. And so with the help of Longevity, we kind of like did some mouse experiments, and I was pretty happy it worked. Like, we could just transplant the cells. We had different ways of transplanting them, so we looked a little bit at like how is the best way to delivering the cells, and we did that in Alzheimer's mice, and yes, they showed some benefit, but the effects were not great. It wasn't really wow, now the mouse is back to being completely normal and young. And so this is, I think, where the field has progressed. The microglia cells are really maintaining their numbers. So the brain seems to have a way of knowing exactly how many microglia cells they are. And so replacing them isn't that easy. And that's also what we saw. Like, we did not see a lot of engraftment. We see the cells, they are functional, they are there, but we can't replace a lot of them. So really one of the advancements, a project that was actually supported by SENS Research Foundation, and also when I was working at SENS, this was one of the projects I love really much, was you first have to basically get rid of the old ones. So the idea was you're adding a little compound, a drug, that stops the microglia cells basically from being alive and happy. So they kind of die off. And then you have an empty place, you have an empty niche, and then engraftment is way better. So he kind of like, there is now a couple of groups that work on this microglia replacement. There are some people in Stanford, it's Professor Jean Hébert in the Einstein Institute that is doing some work in this field as well. He's now also doing more than microglia cells. So he also replaces neurons and endothelial cells. So again, like, the field is coming together. So it's not only microglia replacement, people are now combining different cell types. So that's kind of nice. But the combination of cells, I have not seen that progressing to the clinic yet. The closest I've seen for the microglia cells is actually attempts from a company that is moving forward with a microglia cell therapy in the context of neurodegeneration. So they are not in clinic yet, but they're very close. So it seems to be that, again, this was taken up by a company. It is progressing towards clinic. It's not there yet. So yes, again, if you think like you're looking back 10 years, yes, we did this all in mouse. Nothing is yet FDA approved. So
right. Now, could you speak a little bit, since you have worked in this field specifically in dementia and brain, you know, problems, aging, there, it's kind of been an evolving theory of what causes Alzheimer's and different types of dementia through the years, with the A-beta accumulation, or tau protein accumulation in the brain, or inflammation, the microglia cells, other, you know, neuronal damage. Do you have any feeling as to what might be the root cause for brain aging problems, or do you think it's a comprehensive approach that needs to be taken as far as cleaning out A-beta and also replacing some cells?
Okay, now it gets a little bit more complicated. So most of the research is in the context of familial Alzheimer. In that case, I think root causes are known. We have numbers of risk factors, risk genes that are associated with it. And then we have something that's called the sporadic Alzheimer. And there, it's not known what the causes is. There is an ongoing and lively debate about what it is. I would summarize it as maybe you had bad life choices that you made, and bad environment, bad genes, and it all comes together, and you're the one that gets basically Alzheimer. I think if humans are living long enough, we would all get it eventually. So some people are maybe just more prone to get it earlier, because, I don't know, they had a lot of inflammation going on when they were a child, maybe a lot of virus infections, maybe they live in an environment where there are a lot of like air pollutants around. So all of that adds up, and that might push this person into like a dementia case. So what is the root cause? Aging.
What else can you say, really, right?
Oh, well, that goes back into like, now we could talk about the hallmarks of aging and what is the root cause, and
which we won't, you know, quite talk about, but yeah, basically aging. Just one side point. Are you aware of the Mankato Nun study with Alzheimer's research?
Yes, where they showed
brain scans, they showed all the signs that they should have Alzheimer's, but hardly any of them did. They showed the similar damage to an 80-year-old person that would have Alzheimer's, but they showed no outward signs of that. And that always piqued my interest to think, I always thought that perhaps the brain is plastic enough, it can adapt enough in some people that it can work around that damage and you can still have a normal life. And other people, they can't.
It's also a good idea, like that some brains are more plastic and they can deal with problems and they can kind of like back it up using other areas. But I think in general, the tau and amyloid field has developed as well. And I think people are now more agreeing that amyloid might not be the root cause of Alzheimer's. It's actually maybe more like a part of the defense system, because amyloid is, for example, wrapping around bacteria and viruses. So this idea like that bacteria might be part of it and driving it, and then amyloid comes in and tries to mop it up and kind of protect it or the brain from these bacteria, is now kind of more widely discussed. So it's not like amyloid production, definitely in kind of, again, in the familial cases, it's different. It's slightly different structured and you have other pathways happening. But in the normal cases, in the sporadic cases, it's probably a defense that is overshooting. It's the same with the microglia activation. It's overshooting its
purpose.
Too
much inflammation is a problem.
Exactly. Yeah, too much inflammation is a problem. So I think people have moved on a little bit from like just the tau-centric and amyloid-centric studies. And there's a lot of interesting work going on in that
area.
Even
if, now let's say, even if tau protein and amyloid don't prove to be central to brain aging problems, but kind of a side effect, they just kind of overshoot. To me, it would still seem beneficial to clean up the brain from some of that garbage, as you would say, to get back to normal functioning.
Yeah, so most likely that would be the cause, because it is protein aggregates. And I think we all agree that protein aggregates are one of the damage types that we need to get rid of. If we want to mess with the amyloid processing per se, it's something different. And that's going back to the idea, like if you're messing with the metabolism, you probably have side effects that you don't really want to deal with and that are a downside to a therapy. And it is better to actually attack the damage and just remove the damage, if that is ever possible. But yeah, so that's my kind of like really understanding of the disease. Yes, protein aggregates are bad. getting rid of them is probably good.
Okay, let's move on to another project that Longevity helped with, and that is the Volatome project. And for members just listening now, might recall that you were proposing to measure the rate of aging through your breath, just to measure someone's breath and pick up on their biological age markers. And how did that progress? Have you seen anything positive come out of that?
Yeah. Okay. So there's a little story to it. So initially, I started studying the volatome. And by the way, the volatome, small metabolic compounds that are gas form. So you basically can kind of see them in cell cultures in the gas phase over the cell culture, or you can see them study them in human breath. So it's part of the metabolomics world. You can also capture them from other liquids of the body. But I thought the breath is the easiest because it's not invasive. One can do it at home. So yeah, I started doing this in cell culture and saw that there is something happening when we induce senescence or do replicative senescence. So we saw kind of like a pattern appearing that was gradually changing while the cells became older. And then so I approached basically Longevity with the idea of like, I need some human data, otherwise I will not get a grant. So the idea was to basically build enough data to go to like a funder and say, look, there's something really here. And that luckily happened just this year. So yes, we got the money from Longevity. We took our 20 donors. So thank you for all of the donors, mostly in the Bay Area, that donated a bit of their breath. And again, the data looked interesting. There were changes in the pattern. And so all of this went into a grant with Wellcome Leap because they had a call for frailty. And so now we have a 3-year project where we can do a deep dive into it because 20 patients or 20 donors is really not enough. It's just enough that one can speculate that there might be a change, but not really knowing what is happening. So yes, over the next 3 years, we will measure 400 people. So we take breath of 400 people, mostly of elderly people, and we will see if someone has a fall, stumbling over something on the pavement. And so we will do a before and after measurement and then see who's aging quicker, like what is happening in the volatome of the people that have a fall versus the people that don't have a fall, so that eventually we can build something that is maybe similar to like a Horwath clock. Again, like the Horwath clock is measuring biological age. So while we don't have mortality data yet, this will only kind of like show rate of aging and maybe will show the people that are more vulnerable to have a fall in the future. So that's kind of what we will be doing. And we use AI to like help us really look at the metabolome and see if there's a certain pattern, and also to help us speed up the processing of the data. Because the data is complicated data set and you really need very well trained people. It's massive and it's complicated and it is very subjective. So it depends like what postdoc or what PI is looking at the data set. And that can't really happen. Like now we need to have like, yeah, we need machine learning or deep neural networks,
look at
unbiased analysis of the data. So that's all part of the project.
Okay. And that's happening through Loughborough University.
Yes.
That you'll be directing that.
Yes.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Now, I just thought about that. Do you see, you've been working, obviously, doing a ton of lab work through the years and different aging research projects. Now that we have more data processing capability and AI and things like that to help with the analysis, I mean, have you seen great improvements or a movement forward in a lot of projects? Is it really helping out?
Okay, so let me correct this first. So we're not using AI, we're using machine learning.
Machine learning, sure. I know there's a difference, yeah, okay.
So there is a difference. So to be really precise, we use machine learning. And yes, it definitely has helped. We are much, much faster in analyzing certain types of data. It doesn't really work yet for all the data sets that's very variable, where there is a lot of like other factors involved in like, I don't know, like, for example, who's the donor or what cell type is in it. So where you have like small data sets and a lot of co-founding factors, then it's really complicated. But if you have really nice big data sets, then it's awesome. It's also, I see more of it being used for prediction, for modeling. So yes, absolutely, it is progressing, it is helping, but it's not enough yet.
I can see one problem though with so many different research groups around the world collecting all this data and using machine learning or probably AI as well in the future. It needs to be structured data. And is there some international collaboration on structuring the data between research groups similarly? Because then you're not going to be able to use the data from someone else to apply to your research because it might be interesting, but it doesn't go into your machine learning program. Is there some collaboration on that?
I think they're in the genomic world. I think they are far ahead. So I there might be activities in that area. I must say, in the metabolomic world, and more precisely in the volatile world, it's not happening yet. Not even data sharing. Like, most of the volatile data is not even like in some database available. So, and no, there is no standard set of this is the way we are storing the data, and this is the minimum amount of data that has to come with this data set. Yes, it is very painful, and we will make sure that this does not happen to our data set because we want the data set to be available publicly so that other people can harvest this, do their own analysis. And also within the Wellcome Leap, there's actually 13 different groups that are being funded. And so we also have like a plan to share data within the different groups. So there is definitely a drive towards this. A common set of rules to like store the data and make it available for future analysis. And it's something that is really urgently needed, but I don't see it yet.
Just to kind of get into the last couple of questions here, what's your general feeling on the state of rejuvenation research at this point? You and I both have been working a long time, decades on the effort. And, I've been to many conferences and I've seen so many spectacular studies, mainly in mice and different things, but really nothing has come out yet that is broadly commercially available for just average person for like $1,000, go to the pharmacy and pick up something that's going to help rejuvenate you or turn back Alzheimer's or something like that. So it's been a long time. I know there's a lot of new investment. What's your outlook here? Are we going to see something in the next couple of years that all of a sudden, aha, here's a human study with some senolytics or some other rejuvenation technology? Is it just a couple of years away or we still got a ways to go?
I always hate doing forecasting
I know it's
because it is
difficult.
always so imprecise and it's a lot of guessing. Yes, I think there will be some products available in the next years. Will it have a big effect? No, probably 2, 3, 4, 5 years. The pipeline, I would say, is growing. So it's great. Yes, there's money going in. We have several clinical trials running. Do we have enough? No, absolutely not. Is it being recognized as a field and do people take it more serious? Yes. Is the world population aware of it? No, absolutely not. I talked to friends of mine and they have never heard about it. They would still not think that this is possible or even a thing one could do. And myself, I'm also slightly kind of like pessimistic. I wouldn't say pessimistic, but I am orientating myself more now to cryopreservation work simply as a might not have enough coming out in the next year for myself to like apply and use and extend my healthy years. And so,
Well,
yes, I am focusing more on cryopreservation work as well as a backup plan as people
sure.
think about it.
Yeah, that's obviously a good backup plan. But speaking of that, as I'm talking with you here, you look young and energetic yet, and a lot of longevity members are always trying things to remain healthy and kind of slow that aging clock. Is there anything that recently, when you've been talking with people or you've been in certain groups perhaps where you focus on extending your healthy life, what do you do, anything specific to keep you going in at your age?
I try out stuff, maybe not as aggressively as other members of the community. I do like senolytics quite a bit. So I think the Kirkland senolytics are relatively safe and probably effective. There are loads of clinical trials running with it. So I feel like they are a safe compound. They're also kind of normal parts of our diet. So it's relatively safe to use them. And I've tried them. Not that I can report like awesome results, but then also it is so difficult to trace what works, what doesn't work, because also with kind of consumer biological clocks that one can buy now, the variability between measurements is simply too big to see an effect. Differences between the clocks could be from one measurement to the other 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And I think all of the intervention that we currently have maybe give you 2 years. So how are you to see a difference? Like, you can't even measure it. So that's hard. So you're trying things, but you don't even know if it works.
Maybe the volatome will reveal on a shorter time span, you know, what works and what doesn't, right? Well, Dr. Stolzing, thank you so much for giving us an update on your research throughout the years and your outlook on the future. And we wish you the best with further research here coming up on the volatome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening.
Once again, I would like to thank all of the Longevity members for your yearly donations. Progress seems slow, but if we don't keep pushing forward with support for further research, monetary or otherwise, nothing will happen. Professor Stolzing is a good example of getting important research off the ground. Until next time, I'm Justin Lowe.